You want people to know something about marijuana who are regulating it.
The House passes a bill detailing regulations for legal marijuana. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 14th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, lawmakers vote to keep their new Anchorage office.
As we are telling everybody else to tighten up their belts, we as a legislature then will be occupying the most expensive building in Anchorage.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
Alaska Public Media is inviting all Alaskans to join our online, real-time OVEE screening and chat about the film The Homestretch, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. Just log in at alaskapublic.org and click on the Homestretch banner.
A bill that is fundamental to setting up legal regulations for marijuana in Alaska passed the State House today. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, the bipartisan vote is a step toward the Alcoholic Beverages Control Board establishing a permit structure that oversees a full legal market, from growers to commercial sales.
Barrow Democrat Ben Nagiak got laughs when he spoke during the House floor session. He said there are some basic reasons marijuana needs its own regulatory board.
I mean, geez, every time I see a high people, I go over there because I want to laugh. And then I think we need to have a separate board to have, you know, happy people versus unhappy people.
House Bill 123 sets up a body within the ABC board to start doing exactly what voters opted for on ballot measure 2, regulating marijuana like alcohol. The state has until November 24th to set up a regulatory structure for all the pieces of a legal marijuana market that don't exist yet, from permits to grow to packaging and sales. Republican Liz Vasquez of Anchorage says it's too much work for the board to handle as is.
The staff of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board is simply overwhelmed by the work they have right now to throw in the mix matters dealing with marijuana and so forth. I don't think it's doable. I don't think we're appropriating enough resources to this issue.
One of the biggest issues during the floor session was the fiscal note. Some House members say that at just under $1.6 million, the state can't afford to pay for the four new staff positions it would create in the ABC board. While the marijuana board would be made up of five volunteers coming from different backgrounds, the staff working on their behalf would be full-time state employees. But ABC board director Cynthia Franklin says the money makes all the difference.
We need the money to not only get the people in place to take on this additional substance, but to get the technology in place to be able to answer reporters and legislators' questions about what's happening with marijuana, who's applying for licenses, how we're approaching the subject, and more importantly, assuring the people of Alaska that any marijuana they buy in a retail establishment has been legally grown and can be traced from the time it was born, so to speak, until the time it's sold in the store.
Lawmakers made a number of arguments against the bill. Some worried that it would allow felons to work in the new industry. Others raised concerns about the composition of the board and what count as qualifications when it comes to industry experience. Anchorage Republican Gabrielle Ledoux says such narrow definitions of expertise are unnecessary.
You don't have to be a cannibal to know something about cannibalism. You want people to know something about marijuana who are regulating it.
HB 123 passed 25-15 and now goes before the Senate for consideration. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A bill that applies a uniform code of military justice to the Alaska National Guard will not pass the legislature this year. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
The legislation is a project of the House Judiciary Committee. At a hearing on Tuesday, Chair Gabrielle Ledoux said that the bill will not make it to the floor before the legislature gavels out. Her aide, Thomas Brown, explained that the committee will work with members of the administration on the issue during the interim.
This is a project. It's going to be over interim. We're going to be working with the department. We will craft a better, I hesitate to say perfect bill, but a better bill so that this time next year we can send the governor something that all parties involved can be, you know, content with.
Various versions of a military code bill were introduced in the beginning of session in response to a federal report documenting misconduct in the Alaska National Guard. The bill under consideration now would allow for courts martial and would give the Alaska National Guard the ability to hand down dishonorable discharges. Lieutenant Forrest Dunbar is a judge advocate officer working on the bill on behalf of the Walker administration. He explained to the committee that clearly defined criminal activity perpetrated by guardsmen, like sexual assault or theft, would still be referred to civilian law enforcement. But he said there are instances where the code of military justice is more stringent than the civil code, and it would allow discipline within the Guard for some of the activities described in the federal report.
There was some behavior by guardsmen that involved sexual relations with recruits, and the civilian authorities, for a variety of reasons, decided not to prosecute. So, for example, perhaps there wasn't enough evidence, or it didn't tightly fit the definition of sexual assault. But there are military offenses that are broad enough where we could potentially pursue some of those offenders for things like dereliction of duty, conduct on becoming an officer.
Dunbar added that the bill is expected to bring more order to the Alaska National Guard, but he said he could not definitively answer the most common question about the code.
Had this leg of the stool been present prior to the activities that led to the scandal, could we have avoided those activities and that scandal? And the answer is we're not sure. There's no way to know. I think it would have increased the likelihood that we would have been able to bring good order and discipline to those units more quickly.
A special investigator appointed by Governor Bill Walker is expected to release a public report on the National Guard scandal next month. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Secretary of the Air Force told Alaska officials today that Eielson Air Force Base will keep its F-16 Aggressor Squadron. Alaska Congressman Don Young says it's good news on its own, but it also improves the chances that Eielson will get F-35 aircraft as well.
So it means we have a permanent wing in and Eielson, and the chances of it, no worry about it being moved to Port Richard or Elmendorf or now put the rest in. It's a positive thing, so I feel very good about it.
The Air Force said last fall it was considering moving the 18 F-16s now based near Fairbanks to make room for two squadrons of F-35s. Eielson remains the military's preferred location for the new aircraft, a decision that could mean thousands of new jobs for the Fairbanks area. If Eielson keeps what it has and gains two fighter squadrons, Senator Lisa Murkowski says the base will need additional infrastructure.
I think a very critical cost assessment was made, and the decision to invest in Eielson for the long term was made.
Meanwhile, a U.S. House panel today reviewed the production problems of the F-35s, which include engine failures, software errors, cracked bulkheads, and a fire. As Ohio Republican Congressman Mike Turner points out, the price tag has skyrocketed.
Current acquisition costs are now approaching $400 billion, which, according to GAO, makes this DOD's most costly and ambitious acquisition program.
Still, lawmakers and Pentagon officials say they have to make the program work to produce the next generation of stealth fighters. Congressman Young says the cost overruns concern him, but they reflect massive leaps in technology.
And this plane is going to be the best. It'll be, do everything anybody ever wanted it to do. But it is so far-reaching in modern technology, there's going to be some glitches. But I'm not discouraged about that at all.
Fairbanks is also waiting to hear if the U.S. Army plans to keep Gray Eagle drones at Fort Wainwright. The unmanned vehicles are about the size of a Cessna and similar to the Air Force Predator drones. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, private funding will staff Alaska's Walrus Island State Game Sanctuary this summer.
It's commendable that the Annenberg and the Sea Life Center and the other aquaria around the lower 48 have stepped in to help us manage and protect the site.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online.
Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
In a 13-to-1 vote, the Legislative Council has decided to punt on the question of what to do with the Anchorage Legislative Information Office. The council, a small but powerful group of lawmakers who effectively serve as the legislature's office managers, decided to pay the rent on the building for the year. Senator Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican who chairs the group, said they would give them time to see if they can get out of the lease terms.
We will attempt to enter negotiations with the owners for purchase of the building and the land.
As part of the sole source contract, the state spent nearly $8 million to renovate the Anchorage LIO last year. But the state does not own the property and has instead signed a 10-year lease to use it at an annual rate of $3.5 million. Representative Cherise Millett, an Anchorage Republican who serves as the House Majority Leader, supported delaying action on the Anchorage LIO. She worried about the financial liability if the legislature backed out of the contract.
If we got into a long-term lawsuit over this issue, I don't think that would be good for the state either.
Representative Sam Quito, a Juneau Democrat and the lone minority member on the council, was the only member to oppose the decision. He argued that if the legislature has cheaper office options available now, it should take them.
I do have a concern that as we are telling everybody else to tighten up their belts because we don't have a lot of money, that we as a legislature then will be occupying the most expensive building in Anchorage.
The legislature currently faces a lawsuit over the Anchorage LIO over damages allegedly caused to nearby properties during its renovations. The Aleutians East Borough is closing its second school in 3 years. The school board voted last week to shut down the Cold Bay School, with state budget cuts looming and enrollment on the decline. As KUCB's Annie Ropik reports, locals are worried the closure could put the tiny community in jeopardy.
Sandy Lopez's twin boys, Matt and Zenny, are sixth graders at the Cold Bay School. The pair grew up in the town and celebrated their 12th birthdays at school on Friday. Cold Bay's four students are all in the same age group.
A real personal education, and you know, they're very attached to each other. They've gone to this school their whole life, and you know, they do very well.
Lopez says Cold Bay has been a safe, sheltering place to raise her kids, but her family and several others will likely have to move away when the town's school shuts its doors at the end of the semester. The Cold Bay School has had fewer than 10 students for 4 years now. That means it no longer receives state funding. Until now, the Aleutians East Borough School District has been paying for Cold Bay on its own. But this year, major state funding cuts could create a $500,000 deficit across the district. School Board President Tiffany Jackson says it would cost another $211,000 on top of that to keep the Cold Bay School open.
Nobody wants to be talking numbers because all of our children are so important. They're all so important. But it just economically, we didn't think that we could absorb the cost.
The school district hasn't finalized its budget yet, but Jackson says they haven't asked the Aleutians East Borough for extra money to help keep Cold Bay afloat. The borough is already close to maxed out on its local contribution. They gave the schools about $1 million this year. The district decides how to dole that money out. Some residents have questioned why the borough couldn't spare funds for Cold Bay when it invests millions of dollars in capital projects elsewhere in the region. Borough Administrator Rick Gifford says they can't give much more than they already do.
We fund the schools based upon their budget and their budget request up to, you know, to as much as we are able to without going over the cap. And then we fund projects in each of the communities, hopefully to bring in economic development that will then bring in families to the communities.
Superintendent Michael Seifert says Aleutians East will reopen the Cold Bay School if enrollment rises above 10 kids again. But some parents aren't sure that'll be possible. Candace Shack has lived in Cold Bay for more than a decade and had hoped her 2-year-old daughter would go to school there. But now her family and most others with kids will have to relocate. Homeschooling isn't an option for parents who work. And Shack worries the community will start to dissolve.
It's going to leave us with really no room for growth. Cold Bay has so much potential, but I don't see people moving here with a family if there's no school.
Shack grew up in nearby Nelson Lagoon, which had its school closed 3 years ago. enrollment hasn't bounced back, and soon the borough may have to tear the school building down.
The whole village is just falling to pieces. I hate to say that, but it really is. It's a really bad thing for the community to have that happen.
Cold Bay is more transient than most towns in the borough. It's not a fishing community or a native village, and most of its 100 or so residents are government employees. Many work at the airport, which is used for emergency stops by jets crossing the Pacific.
They can land here. And then the place that has the most room and bathrooms and a kitchen and all of that is the school.
That's teacher and principal Carrie Burkhart. Her school is also the tsunami shelter and a space for potlucks, open gym hours, and free shelter for travelers. Burkhart wishes the school board had given her an extra year to try to boost enrollment. With that time, she says locals could have recruited more families to the open jobs in Cold Bay. That's been tough with the school on the chopping block.
We were sorry to hear and to see that the weather station hired two families with children. They learned that the board was thinking of closing, and so they turned the jobs down. That was a great loss, and I feel as though we would have been all right.
Now the school building will be turned over to the borough, like the school in Nelson Lagoon. Burkhart says she hopes it'll be kept stocked with supplies in case it ever reopens. And whatever happens, she wants the district to remember Cold Bay's proud history.
One year for Battle of the Books, Cold Bay took state. We've had kids who had perfect SAT scores. We've had all sorts of marvelous community members and people that go off in the world. This school has been vibrant and important to many families for many years.
She's hoping their last semester will be a strong finish to help students find some closure. Burkhart herself leaves a long legacy at the Cold Bay School. Her own daughters went there in the 1990s when there were 40 students and many more jobs in town. Now her daughters are in grad school, and Burkhart is looking for work. She says she's grateful for the district's offer of a placement at a different school, but she plans to move away too. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
A group of Juneau residents is challenging a transitional home for former female inmates in their neighborhood. The Juneau Assembly heard the appeal last night. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Andrew Hughes and the Tall Timbers Neighborhood Association contend the conditional use permit granted to Haven House in October by the Juneau Planning Commission was improper. Each side of the appeal had 30 minutes to present its arguments. Prior to the hearing, the Assembly had about 1,700 pages of supporting documents to review. Representing the Tall Timbers Neighborhood Association, attorney Dan Bruce argued Haven House is a halfway house. He quoted how city code defines a halfway house.
A single-family dwelling for not more than 9 persons over the age of 12, together with not more than 2 persons providing supervision and other services to such persons, all of whom shall live together as a single housekeeping unit. Residents may be serving a sentence for a criminal act. That is Haven House. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Under city code, halfway houses are not allowed in typical residential districts, like the zoning that covers Melissa Drive in the Mendenhall Valley, where Haven House is located. Bruce said the short-term residents of Haven House would not take ownership of the neighborhood, and its presence would lower property values.
This is the wrong move. It is placing transitory individuals with criminal records in a stable and mature neighborhood. And I think that's completely inappropriate. And I think it is, in effect, a social experiment. And the people of this neighborhood are being asked to be part of the experiment.
Attorney Mary Alice McKean represented Haven House. She said Haven House is not a halfway house, and the head of Alaska's Department of Corrections agrees.
And the reason is that people live at Haven House by their choice. They are not sentenced to live at Haven House. The women living in Haven House could live anywhere, as long as they got the permission of their probation or parole officer.
Representing the Planning Commission, Assistant City Attorney Robert Palmer III said Haven House is considered transitional housing and is allowed in a residential neighborhood with a conditional use permit.
The record clearly establishes that there is substantial evidence that transitional housing will improve the public health and safety. The structure complies with all fire and building codes, and probably most importantly, evidence was presented that the recidivism rate without transitional housing is roughly 60%, With transitional housing as proposed by Haven House, the recidivism rate drops down to 20%.
The assembly met later that night to deliberate. City Attorney Amy Mead says the assembly has 45 days to issue its decision to the parties. Haven House is currently operating on Melissa Drive with staff, including a live-in manager, and two residents. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The men and women of Public Employees Local 71 keep the Hall Road and thousands more miles of Alaska highways clear of snow and sleet in winter and safe for travel in the summer. 2,500 members strong with 74 workstations across Alaska. Public Employees Local 71. Working hard for Alaska, working hard for you. This message is sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
A group of 10 Alaska salmon producers, which represent nearly three-quarters of the Alaska's salmon harvest, are attempting to rejoin the Marine Stewardship Council label. The seafood companies left MSC in 2012, adopting instead the Alaska-based Responsible Fisheries Management. Since then, companies have struggled to sell to some markets, especially in Europe. Norm Van Vactor, the president and CEO of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Association, has criticisms of MSC, but says the companies probably should have kept the label. Van Vactor says he's glad to see they're trying to rejoin now.
I think that the importance of a label such as MSC is definitely questionable, and again, given different circumstances, you know, is open for debate. But at the end of the day, you know, especially as it relates to the European consumer base, MSC is held in quite high regard, and it's a significant tool for salespeople that are trying to sell Alaska salmon to be able to get into certain marketplaces and get our product out in front of consumers.
Silver Bay Seafoods heads up the MSC client group in Alaska's wild salmon fisheries. How easily negotiations will go for the others to rejoin and cost share for the certification remains to be seen. The Alaska salmon producers who are seeking to rejoin MSC say they will keep the RFM label too. Round Island, the centerpiece of Alaska's Walrus Island State Game Sanctuary, will remain staffed this summer and perhaps next, thanks to private funding. Last year, citing state budget cuts, Fish and Game's Division of Wildlife Conservation removed funding for the program, which cost around $100,000 annually. Since then, the search has been on for private funding to keep the Round Island program alive, which includes a small staff on the island through the summer. Joe Meehan, the Lands and Refuges Program Coordinator for Fish and Game, said the confirmation that funding had come through was welcome news.
The private entities that stepped forward to help us fund it is wonderful, and we're going to be on the island. We're going to be there for a couple of reasons. One is to facilitate a visitor program out there so people can come out and enjoy the wildlife, particularly the walrus and the seabirds that are out there on the island, but also to protect the island, the sanctuary, and add to the conservation of walrus.
The Annenberg Foundation was the first to step forward with possible funding to keep the program in place. After that, the Alaska Sea Life Center and several aquariums from around the country contributed. The state also receives a federal grant from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Meehan says the private funds total about $200,000, which should carry the program through two summers. Round Island is the largest and longest used terrestrial haulout for the sanctuary's namesake, Pacific Walrus.
They traditionally, in historic times, had hauled out at other places, but they abandoned all those other places by the time of statehood. And around the time of statehood, Round Island was the only place in Alaska that walrus regularly hauled out on land. And actually, one of the first acts that the Alaska State Legislature did shortly after statehood was to select the Walrus Islands as land for the state from the federal government and turn it into a sanctuary.
Monday marked the 55th anniversary of the sanctuary's creation by the Alaska State Legislature. The island is open to visitors from May 1st through August 15th. A Fairbanks animal advocate is continuing her effort to rescue a loose dog in the Anderson area. As KUIC's Dan Bross reports, the so-called Denali Highway Dog has been wandering through communities along the park's highway since last summer.
Mary Micah is trying to get permission to set a cage trap on land in the Anderson Clear area near mile 283 of the park's highway. Her aim is to humanely catch the large mixed-breed dog suspected to have been abandoned by its owner last summer about 100 miles away on the Denali Highway.
I'm just trying to give the dog a chance for a better life and to get the trap placed and try to get some volunteers just to look and see if the dog is in there. This would be just a request for kind-hearted people just to look at the trap, be aware that it's out there.
The dog gradually made its way north along the park's highway last year, living off handouts and garbage and always eluding capture. Micah, who says she's successfully rescued abandoned pets in the past, leaves cooked meat out for the dog every weekend, food she hopes replaces handouts from Clear Air Force Station employees who were recently banned from feeding the dog.
They had received a report that the dog was chasing after cars, and there is an interpretation of aggressive dog behavior. And so basically the dog is, everyone believes it to be just that the dog is chasing the car to try to get cars to stop to give him food.
Micah says she's made contact with Anderson City officials and issued a flyer in hopes of garnering local support for the rescue effort. Micah has seen the dog a few times and describes him as very afraid.
I believe the dog could have a much better life if he could be recovered, get some rehabilitative efforts such as getting him used to people again, try to find a suitable home, just to give him the chance that he deserves.
Micah says there's increased urgency to rescuing the dog this spring before summer tourist traffic picks up along the park's highway, increasing the likelihood of the dog causing an accident or being hit. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Annie Ropeek on Alaska, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez and Zachariah Hughes reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com. Earn a Master of Public Administration from the University of Alaska Southeast online on your schedule while having the structure of the classroom and the accessibility of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. Alaska Public Media invites Alaskans to our statewide online screening and chat in real time about the film The Homestretch and Homeless Teens, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. To join our conversation, go to alaskapublic.org and click on the Homestretch banner. Lori Townsend, News Director of Alaska Public Media, is our moderator, who will be joined with panelists from across the state. See you online Friday, April 17th, starting at 12 p.m.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.